Golf Smarter number 375, published on March 19, 2013, is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter. And by Alpha Brain by Onnit Labs. Alpha Brain contains 11 ingredients perfectly tailored to the most mental of games and clinically tested to improve driving accuracy. Learn more by clicking on the Alpha Brain ad at golfsmarter.com. And on today's Score Zone Short Game Academy, the wedge guy addresses a listener's question about adjusting the lie angle of your wedges just like the pros.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome to the Golf Smarter podcast, John.
Hello, Fred.
How you been?
Very good, thanks.
How are the lessons coming?
Well, I don't usually do too much in the wintertime. Most of my lesson business is through travel. So I'll travel, you know, between 2 and 4 weekends a month. Just especially springtime is starting to pick up quite a bit now.
Yeah. And to just clarify for the audience, John is not speaking with me and sword fighting at the same time. His dog is actually, we talked about this, his dog is walking around the room with his nails on the tile. So, John, a few episodes back, we talked to Mark Sweeney about the Aimpoint golfing system, putting system that he developed. And it was, to me, it's a fascinating story of a guy with an idea and how he developed it and turned it into something very useful and brought it on to teachers all over the world.
Yes.
And you have embraced Aimpoint.
Certainly, yeah.
As a matter of fact, I think you told me that you're not even giving normal golf lessons anymore. You're just doing Aimpoint exclusively.
Yeah, almost exclusively. I'll teach very little full swing. It's getting less and less and less over the years, and it's nearly nothing now.
And from your perspective, and this is why I was so excited to have you on the show, because, you know, there's so many different theories on putting. But as a certified instructor of, I'm assuming you're a PGA certified instructor as well.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So as a PGA certified instructor and as an Aimpoint certified instructor, what is it about Aimpoint that you love? And why should we embrace it?
The reason that I love it is because I can prove it. I can prove it right on the putting green while I'm teaching it that here's the scenario, here's the hole, here's the ball, here's the surface. We can do a read, we can get it right, we can get it wrong. Whichever the answer is, I can go out and figure out why I got it right or why I got it wrong and measure it and prove it. That's why I got involved.
So it's all about being able to quantify everything.
Exactly correct.
All right, move on. I want details. I want to know, again, from your perspective, what it is that you teach. And I'd like to just open the floor here and let you go. And you know, obviously it's not visual, but if you can walk us through the elements of it and why we should fall in love with this too.
Sure. I mean, first we start off with explaining to people what actually causes the ball to break. What are the actual true variables involved? And you know, there's basically three, and those three are, you know, how steep is the ground between the ball and the hole that the ball is rolling across? What direction is the ball rolling across the ground? We use the term angle. What angle is it crossing the ground? And then the third one is, how long is it doing it for? So if I can figure out what those three things are, how steep, what angle, and for how long, based on those things, physics and science says we can predict the ball should do this. Now, certainly we can't control if it hits a ball mark or hits a spike mark, whatever the case may be, and things of that nature. You know, the green's not a perfect surface, but we have, you know, between 30 and 40 seconds to make the best estimate that we can make. And if you know what the variables are, how to find them and measure them, We can do that very, very quickly and be done sometimes almost before we actually get to our ball from the fairway. We can start doing this process from hundreds of yards away. And then we just get there and we kind of refine our answer based on what we know that we're looking for. So it's a very specific process of things that we're looking for. The time element is mainly broken down into our distance from the hole and the speed of the green. There's other things involved in that, like grain and wind, things of that nature, which are much harder to quantify because they tend not to be very consistent. You know, winds coming in and out. So the main things that we deal with, again, are how steep, what angle, then you could say, you know, how fast is the green, and then how far away. So that's what it was. Once we figure those things out, we have a piece of paper that we look at saying, okay, based on these inputs, the answer should be X. And then we go from there and try to hit it with the assumption that our skills are going to hit a ball that delivers it between 6 and 12 inches past the hole. That's one of the assumptions that we kind of build in, is that every putt we're going to try and hit at the same distance relative to where we are and where the hole is. So it's working on, you know, the actual skill, the feels involved of determining what those variables are. So that's the art part. That's still there. That's never changed. We look at it. We feel it. We do all those things trying to figure out what those pieces are. Then the science piece is, okay, based on our skill and our feel, we come up with this answer. And then now we have the harder of the two parts, in my opinion, which is actually hitting it there at the correct speed, aiming it there, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, all of those variables I can go in and I can measure while I'm practicing and say, okay, I thought the ground was this steep and it was this steep. I thought I was coming from this direction, I was coming from that direction. I thought I was 8 feet away when I was 10 feet away. Whatever the situation is, I can do something to measure it to find out how well I've practiced versus how well I determined it in the real world, and continually work on these skills that I can quantify. And like you said, it's quantifying feel is a great way to explain what we're trying to do. Saying, okay, we need to figure out what these things are. We're going to put an actual number on them, not just, well, it's a little downhill and it goes a little to the right. We want to know exactly how much downhill it is, how steep the ground is that it's going down, all of those things. And based on the accuracy of our skills, determines the accuracy of our read. Instead of just having it being a kind of a memory device, which is what normal green reading is, in my opinion, at least the way I was taught it, is you look at the ground, you look at the ball, look at the hole, maybe go to the other side, maybe throw the bucket of water on the green, whatever the situation may be. And then I use that information and try to apply it in the future when I run across it again. Well, the problem with that is that those only include the variables of the ground itself. For example, if I had, you know, let's say a 10-foot putt across the slope, on two different days, I can have it roll across the exact same ground and break completely different amounts because of either the speed of the green or how hard I hit it or whatever the case may be. There's some other element in there besides just the ground itself that's going to help me to predict what it's going to do. And if I only play the same course all the time, or at least a course that has the same speed of the green all the time, I can get very good at applying what I see now to the future. As soon as I go to a new course or come to my course on like the Invitational or Member Guest Day and the greens are faster than normal or slower than normal, whatever the case may be, I have no way now to predict what the curve will be based on all of my experience because they no longer apply to the same situation. So I will constantly struggle trying to figure out, why does this ground look exactly what I'm used to, but the ball is doing something different? So you're trying to teach people to kind of get out of that kind of, you know, the endless loop of, you know, apply to the current what I saw in the past, instead of saying, okay, here's what the actual variables are. Let's figure out what they are and then just apply them to the situation that I have. It's just a very different process of doing it. You know, it's very similar to, you know, the change from, you know, 60, 70 years ago where every full shot was an eye-based event. I look at the green, here I am, I predict about how far away I am, and I choose a club based on that visual appearance, and through time I start to build a relationship between what I see and my distance and what club that equals. And I'm sure at some point in time when yardage markers and lasers became more prevalent, the golfers that had learned the skill of doing it by sight were very reluctant to switch because they had invested all of this time and this energy and this skill in learning that visual event. But nowadays, nobody plays golf that way.
Right.
You know, all of the players that play for a living are mapping the course out in advance or shooting lasers or getting as much detailed information as they can get to help them make that one choice. It's that same idea that we're bringing to the green, that instead of it being just a strictly visual event, it's an area that can be measured and can be quantified and can be learned as a skill, and then we apply science to an answer.
I am way too 21st century centric, because when you said an eye-based event, I thought you were talking about a new product from Apple. I was like, what? Oh, EYE. Oh, got it. Okay, I won't do that anymore. How many other, dare I call it a system, aim point, we'll call aim point a system at this point. How many other systems have you experienced, studied, and taught before you concluded that aim point was it?
When I started with aim point, I wasn't aware of any other system that proposed to do what Mark was doing. In fact, I mean, you don't know me from a hill of beans, but when I first heard about it, I specifically got in contact with Mark to try and figure out what was wrong with it. There's no more skeptical person than myself in filtering information as it comes in. You know, I have four kids, and especially in the wintertime, I spend a lot of time at home researching and doing stuff online, trying to gather info. And so when I had heard about this, I'm like, oh, this is interesting. No one's ever tried to say they could do this. I want to get a hold of this guy and figure out what's wrong with it. Well, how can I break this thing so it doesn't actually work? And when we got together, you know, he was able to measure and quantify the things that he was doing, so I couldn't really argue with him, so I got involved. Now, since then, I believe there are two other systems that are at least maybe even more than that, maybe three, that are kind of working off the same idea of at least trying to predict what the ball will do. But I have not had any personal experience with either of those other systems, aside from just what I've read online or heard from others. But I have never been to another class of another system to see exactly what they do.
Do you know what the other systems are?
I don't know the name of one. Jeff Mangum's got one, some kind of wheel, but I don't know if he's got a name for it. There's a new one out that...
Is that the Vector one?
No, that's a different one. That's a different one. Mm-hmm. And there's another one that a guy who used to do yardage books for the tour, I think his name is
John
Straka.
Grand.
And he's, and just within the last couple of weeks or so, he's used all the topography information he's gathered on tour to generate an app to say, okay, well, if the hole's here and the ball's here, the ball should break like so. But it's right on the phone. You know, it would be completely illegal, but
that's not going to stop us.
That's the reason, exactly. So those are the only other ones that I'm aware of that attempt to try and quantify break based on location, which is what we're doing.
It's not John Grund. I know that John Grund did the yardage, the sprinkler heads, but not the yardage guides.
No, yeah, I think it's, and I know his last name is Straka. I'm just not sure if his first name is John, but Straka, I think, Straka.
Yeah, I've seen that before too. And Jeff Mangum has been a regular on Golf Smarter for years.
Mm-hmm.
And he's quite detail oriented.
No doubt.
And
yes.
If you ever looked at his website.
Oh, I've engaged with Jeff many times, and detailed is a great way to describe Jeff's responses.
I won't say obsessive. I'll just say detailed.
Yeah. Detailed, yes. Yeah.
Jeff, you're so entertaining. All right. Well, anyway, we're going to get into, I hope you allow me to get into specifics about the elements of Aimpoint and what we can learn from you without obviously getting a clinic. This is about as close as we're going to get right now.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But you do give, I know you were here in Northern California just recently doing clinics all over the country, all over the world, all the time?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was just in at the Metal Club up in Fairfax just last weekend. I'll be in Phoenix this weekend, and then a few days for the LPGA event. And
oh, great.
pretty much every weekend from now until almost the 4th of July. It's going to be a busy spring.
Great. Well, I apologize for missing you. I was out of town. I would have loved to have come up to the Meadow Club.
Yeah, it would have been great.
Yeah, it would have been fun. Let me take a break right here to say that this episode of the Golf Smarter podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible would like to provide the Golf Smarter listeners with an opportunity to give their service a try by giving you a free audiobook of your choice from their huge library. And I'm going to toss it out to you, which I really enjoy doing because I get great recommendations on books. Any books that that you've read or heard recently that you'd like to recommend to our audience?
Yeah, I think one great one for the car, especially for the car, would be the Little Red Book. It's kind of musings by Harvey Penick. Excellent little book.
Oh, and lucky for us, it would be a great book to start. And if you've not done audiobooks, this is a great way to try it. The unabridged version is only an hour and a half long, and it's narrated by Jack Whitaker, who for years and years was the announcer on golf on TV. Again, it's Harvey Penick's Little Red Book, Lessons and Teachings from a Lifetime of Golf by Harvey Penick and Bud Schrake. Again, narrated by Jack Whitaker. And that could be your free book if you'd like. It's a great recommendation, John. Thank you very much. And to get that free audiobook or any book that you want, just go to audiblepodcast.com. Audible is spelled A-U-D-I-B-L-E. A-U-D-I-B-L-E podcast.com. One word, audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter. audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter. Thank you very much for that, John.
You're very welcome.
All right. Now, please, I want to get into details. I've been, ever since I talked to Mark, I've been fascinated by this without having to get the lesson. I wanted to get one. But I've been, you know, looking at greens lately. I mentioned recently I live right off of a private golf course, so I get to walk around the greens when people aren't around and look at it and trying to identify slope, and which is the fall line, which is the line that is, if we just drop the ball right here, it's just going to not break at all. It's just going to go dead straight.
Right.
Explain to me how we can do that on a green without dropping a ball. I mean, let's go through the various steps on what it requires and how we learn how to do that.
Well, there's a multiple of ways, and I'm sure Jeff has shared some. There's only a few ideas that actually, hold true to at least what we're trying to do. I mean, when we're teaching it, especially to someone who's had a little bit of experience, again, we'll start as from any distance away, where they can see the ball and the surface and the flag. They can see those things. We start trying to identify the fall line from hundreds and hundreds of yards away. Generally speaking, in terms of a general slope direction, sometimes that's easier to see from a distance relative to the high and low points that kind of surround the surface itself. So we've actually had tournaments where we do all of the green reading from off the green just to see how well we can do. And then once you get there, you kind of refine it. But so when you're on the green, it can still be a sight event for sure, trying to figure out, relative to, where the hole is and where the ball is. And if we're assuming that we're crossing a single surface, we'll start with the easiest one first. The surface between the ball and the hole is consistent. It's the same direction and the same amount throughout. Now, certainly that doesn't happen on all putts, but for the easiest of ones, we'll kind of start there. But it's trying to figure out, in that area between the ball and the hole, what direction is the ground going? As you mentioned, what direction is the fall line? I've used pictures of taking a hose and stuffing it in the hole and filling it up with water and, figuring out where the water would come out. We've talked about walking a circular shape around the hole, and then based on how you feel changes of elevation, you can feel where the fall line will be. you know, if you're kind of walking a half of a circle, you at some point you'll be walking down, and the other part you'll be walking up. Where that change is will be where the fall line is. You know, another way that we do it is strictly just by sight, you know, just by looking at the hole, trying to figure out what's the high and low part on the hole. We also do it by, in terms of just general all overall balance. You know, the body is designed to keep us upright and vertical so that we don't fall over. And based on just the way that we're standing on the surface, our body will make some adjustment to that. And in certain directions that we're going to be facing, we'll get a sensation of balance that, okay, this is facing up the hill or this is facing down the hill straight, where if I was facing across the hill, I'd have one foot lower than the other. You can kind of visualize that. So trying to figure out a balance relationship within our own body as to where the fall line would be based on how we're actually just standing on the ground would be one of the last ways that we do it.
When you're circling the hole, trying to, and I loved when Mark talked about how you can, if you close your eyes, you can kind of feel where the slope of the green and how it's changing while you're walking around it. But absolutely. Are you walking around it from 2 feet away, 5 feet, 10 feet? What is the optimum distance that you're circling the hole that you can feel where the fall line is?
It really varies. I mean, in a perfect world, if the green was perfectly flat and tilted, you would do it at whatever distance your ball was away. It wouldn't matter because it would all be the same. Now, in the real world of greens, the fall line is not a nice, straight, continuous line. So we try to figure out the fall line that's between our ball and the hole. So the walking one we don't use because generally you have to do it in a manner that's too far away from where the ball is. So, you know, it's kind of taught to do it below where the hole is. Well, if the ball's not near below where the hole is, the fall line could completely change somewhere else relative to the fall line that's below the hole. So we don't really use that. We try to figure out the fall line that's between the ball and the hole, the fall line the ball's actually going to roll across as precisely as we can by doing more of that balance feel between the ball and the hole.
I love the image that you painted of, I always thought about, you know, which way is, and people like how, which way is the slope, right? On a green, and people always say, oh, well, it goes to the mountains. Oh, it goes to the lake. Well, actually it goes to the irrigation.
Yeah.
Right? So absolutely. I always think like, which way is the water going to flow on this green? But I love the image that you just painted of filling the cup with water. And when it overflows, what direction is it going to flow?
Yeah.
That's really helpful, but it's going to be away from the cup.
It's going to be down the fall line. So there's no necessarily any guarantee that the direction water would flow below the hole is the same direction that water would flow into the hole. That's the hardest one to get right.
Mm.
Unless the green is perfectly flat and tilted, which again is not the real world, that's the only time the direction flowing in would be the same as the direction flowing out. Because the hole isn't necessarily placed on a flat surface, the direction in could be slightly offset from the direction out. And that's much more common than not.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it has some limitations, is it only gives us the fall line directly below the hole. It doesn't necessarily represent the fall line above the hole. We can make a decent estimation based on that, but won't necessarily be as accurate as we would prefer.
And the slope and the grade, are those two different things? And how do we define those as we're out there?
I would say they're the same thing. The slope amount or the grade is you know, one of the big things based on just how steep the ground is between the ball and where the hole is. And then the slope direction, that's the fall line. And then the time would be that third piece that I had mentioned. Mm-hmm. How long does the ball roll for?
Right. And it's obviously going to, well, you know, it's not obvious, but I would think that if you're putting uphill, it's going to actually take longer if you're equidistant, say you're uphill and downhill putts, and you're 10 feet away, that it's going to take longer to get to the hole going uphill than it would downhill.
Yeah, it's exactly the opposite of that, actually.
Really?
And the majority of people make this error, and I think part of it is just because of the way greens are described. For example, if I had two surfaces that were perfectly flat And one green would be a stimp of 8, which would be called a slow green. And the other green was a stimp of 12, which would be called a fast green. And on each green, I was going to hit the ball exactly the same distance, let's say that same 10 feet that you mentioned. The green that's called the slow green, I actually have to hit with more force. I have to hit it harder to travel that same distance because it has additional friction on it. So that ball actually rolls faster for the amount of distance that it's rolling. The ball on the 12, I hit with less speed, with less force. That ball rolls a lot slower for a lot longer and long amounts of time for that same 10 feet. So a slow green has the fastest rolling golf balls on it. A fast green has the slowest rolling golf balls on it. Just like a downhill putt is considered fast, has the slowest rolling ball on it. And uphill putts that are considered slow, you have to hit them hardest, they have the fastest rolling putts on it. It's been a poor way of describing what slow and fast greens are relative to what the ball's actually doing on them. You know, the only reason an 8 breaks less than a 12 is because I have to hit it harder and it travels for less time. That's why it breaks less. You know, we could have the exact same ground, same everything else, but the reason why it breaks less is because I'm hitting it harder. It's traveling for a less amount of time. Less time, less amount of time that gravity can affect it, less break over the same distance. So it's and most people, once you explain that to them, go like, oh, duh, okay, yeah, I get that. I just wasn't thinking right. But it's a fairly common misconception that I run across in the clinics that I do.
Well, I would generally say I'm totally baffled by what you said, but I think I followed you on this one.
Yeah, just think about whatever amount of force that you're hitting the ball with, that's controlling the time element, generally speaking.
Okay.
You know, and if I'm hitting them all the same distance, but I have to hit one harder than the other, then the one that I'm hitting harder is going to travel that distance in less time than the one I'm hitting softer.
I have so many more questions for you. I want to know, could you stick around so that you can also answer these questions and we do a Golf Smarter for Members Only episode? Can we do another one?
Oh, absolutely. I'd be happy to.
Oh, that's great. All right. So we're going to have John. I'm going to have one more question before we go, but I just want to let the audience understand that John will continue this conversation on the details of the Aimpoint putting system on our next episode, which is Golf Smarter for Members Only. And if you are not a member of Golf Smarter for Members Only, I encourage you to check it out at golfsmarter.com, because with your membership, you will not only get a new episode every single week that we publish one, you'll get part two of many of the conversations that we have, but you'll also have access to our entire archives. And now that Golf Smarter is up in the high 300 number, there's a lot of conversations that will help your golf game. So please, I encourage you, I ask you to support Golf Smarter and help it stay alive by joining Golf Smarter for Members Only and take advantage of the benefits that also include additional discounts. My last question before we get to the Members Only, though, is your follow-up with your students on, I know one person who's done Aimpoint was totally fired up about it and tried to get me to understand everything. He tried to give me the lesson. And then 2 months, 3 months later, we were out playing and I noticed that he wasn't using his book. He wasn't going into the details. I asked him, I thought you were doing Aimpoint. And he said, it was too much. And I got it and I don't really need to do it anymore. How is the long-term reaction from your students? Have you been following up on that?
You know, it really varies quite a bit depending on the student. I mean, there are certain personality types that enjoy the idea of trying to get the answer right, and will pursue the process in the effort to get the answer right, and spend additional time practicing and learning how to do it so that they can get the answer right. There's other types of personalities that don't necessarily need to get the right answer, but just want to get an answer that's kind of okay, and then they can just kind of, you know, fill in the gaps with their own feel or whatever on their own. I completely understand both ideas and concepts. You know, I certainly fall into the more exacting side based on, you know, the way that I think and my preferences, and because of that, I will do the extra work to get the answer that I want. I know a lot of people will feel that, you know, trying to learn a green reading system based on actual true numbers takes away their feel, and it becomes too thoughtful and too mechanical, or whatever the case may be. You know, yet at the same time, you know, you ask them what their driver launch conditions are, and they know their angle of attack and their club path and the spin rate and their launch and all the other kind of stuff, where they know exactly, you know, they're going to shoot a laser from here to the flag. But if I tell them to aim 3 inches out, they're like, I just want to kind of hit it about a cup out or whatever. It's an interesting dichotomy between, you know, the preferences of some people relative to wanting exactness in other areas, and then wanting a little bit of vagueness in others. So it completely depends on the person. I've certainly run into both types. There's no question that most people underestimate the amount of skill required to do it well, and the amount of practice to do it well. There was a gentleman that I saw at a conference. His name was Dr. Brett McCabe, who had an LPGA player who had learned the system and was doing quite well with it. And then a few months later, he had noticed kind of the same thing, that she hadn't been doing it so much. And he had asked her, you know, what's been the change? And she goes, well, you know, I've learned it all. I think I got it. And Dr. McCabe's response was like, you know, aim point is a skill. It's not a gift. It's not one of the information piece, which is the putt prediction break amounts. That's the science piece. The actual skills required to generate the answer that will provide the correct amount of break requires a great amount of skill that requires continual maintenance and practice to do well. Especially living up north, you know, I'll go, especially on the holidays, I won't step on the ground, actual ground, for, you know, months at a time. And then when I go to teach, I can certainly sense that my perception of the skills I need to be able to do to perceive what the ground is doing have lessened. And that it takes a little bit of time for me to get back into reacclimating my skill set to what the reality of the ground actually is. So a lot of people aren't necessarily familiar with the idea that it's not just information. It's an actual skill, just like their golf swing is. And then if they don't do it, it gets worse. Or some people may make mistakes and then not know that they made mistakes and think that the science is bad, because it didn't match what they had. I run across that one more often than not, that, you know, someone will do a read and what the ball actually does doesn't match what the chart did, and they just assume that whatever they did was correct and what the numbers on the chart were wrong, without ever going back to check to see, well, did I have the slope right? Did I have the angle right? Did I have the distance right? Did I have the inputs right or not? And if they're not checking and they're not diligent with that, it's very easy to say, well, you know, this book is wrong and I'm always right. It's just the different personalities.
Awesome. We're going to continue. I'm going to go to that next question, but we'll do it on our next episode. Thanks again for agreeing to stick around. And thanks so much for your insight on this and your help.
Certainly. Thank you for having me.
It's time once again for our Score Zone Short Game Academy with the Wedge Guy, Terry Kaler, CEO of Score Golf. And if you have a question for Terry that you'd like answered on the show, please go to golfsmarter.com and click on the Score Zone Short Game Academy button and submit your question, because if Terry answers it, he's going to give you a free customized Score 4161 scoring tool. You'll also get a Golf Smarter Switchblade Divot Repair Tool, but more importantly, you're going to get a new wedge. Not a wedge, a scoring club. Hey, Terry, how are you?
I'm great, Fred. How are you doing?
Fine. You know, I'm not going to talk about this much, but I'm taking lessons now. I've never taken lessons, but I'm taking lessons now. And my teacher posed a question to me that I want to throw out to you. What is the objective of golf?
Drink beer and have fun.
Yeah.
No.
That's what I said, and he said he fired me.
The objective of golf? That's an interesting question. Did you answer it for him?
Oh, I answered it many ways, and he kept looking at me like, stop making it so difficult. Stop getting so deep. Stop being
ethereal. The simple objective of golf is you hit it from here until it goes in the hole, and then you go do it again 17 more times.
You win. It's put the ball in the hole. So
the only thing that counts is how many times you had to hit it to get it in the hole, and nobody gives you bonus points for which clubs you used or how far you hit it. The only thing you get points for is how many times did you hit it before it was in the hole.
Right. And
it's all that counts.
Right. And his point, and I'm so glad we're talking about this on this show during our Short Game Academy. We just finished a conversation about putting. His point is it doesn't matter how long you hit the ball. You know, you can hit it 250 and send it right up the middle, or 275, 300 right up the middle. That's not going to get you as excited as hitting a 20-foot putt or chipping from off the green and putting it in the hole, right?
That's right.
So his whole point
Watson
is...
Tom Watson wrote about that in his book, Getting Up and Down, that he learned the game when he was a little bitty kid. His dad took him out the putting green and gave him a little cut-down putter and a ball and said, here, put it in the hole. And so, you know, he dropped it 4 or 5, 6 feet, whatever. And, you know, he couldn't make it go in the hole, so he would just go set it right next to the hole and then tap it to where it would go in, because that was what was fun, is watching the ball go in the hole, because that was what he was there for. And Watson said to this day he does not like anybody hitting a putt back to him. He likes to finish the hole, whether it's 2-incher, 6-incher, 10-incher, 2-footer. He wants to put the ball in the hole, because that is the point of the game.
Right, and what I like to call the happy sound.
Yeah,
that happy sound of the ball going.
Most golfers in most recreational games or hitting putts back to it, and you may play 18 holes of golf and only actually hear the happy sound 3 or 4 or 5 times.
Right.
And guys are hitting your 1-footers and your 10-inchers back to you, and the next thing you know, it's like, I never really finished anything today.
Hmm.
Pretty interesting.
All right. So the point is, get the ball in the hole and do it as little as possible. But the objective of golf is... But thank you very much, Mr. Teacher, who I'm not allowed to talk about. Anyway, we do have a great question that came in from Paul Arellano, or Paul Arellano, but I think it's Paul Arellano from Vista, California. And he wants to know, well, Terry, he writes it this way. I've read that pro golfers usually have their lie angles flattened. Is that something everyone should do as well? Or do you need to swing a certain way before flattening lie angles on wedges?
Well, it is very common, Paul, and all the listeners out there, for the tour players to play their wedges 1 to 2 degrees flatter than they play their irons. Now, this is proportionately flatter, please. So if your irons are 2 degrees upright, you might want to play your wedges 1 or even standard. If your irons are standard, you might want to play your wedges 1 to 2 degrees flat. The reason the tour players do this is because it helps them set their hands in the low position at address that they want. And good players, and I always encourage golfers to watch video of good players hitting short game shots, wedge shots, full swing nine irons, you know, and particularly the little delicate shots around the green. And you'll see these guys crouch a little more in their knees. Their hands are hanging straight below their shoulders, so their hands are lower at address, closer to the ground, than they would be with a full swing 7-iron or 6-iron, because they're standing more upright and for a more powerful swing. And if you don't flatten the lies on your wedges, and you do that, you're going to stick the heel of the club in the ground with a more upright lie golf club. I like to think that the lie of the club is my guide as to how I'm executing. So if I feel the toe of the club or the heel of the club sticking in the ground, I know that was a swing flaw, not a misfit golf club. So if I'm sticking the heel in the ground, I'm getting too low with my hands, which doesn't happen too often. But particularly what most golfers, you'll feel that toe sticking in the ground because you're getting more upright. Your hands are drifting a little further away from your body. And, you know, if you think about it this way, if you set up to the golf club, Paul, and make sure that club is soled flat on the ground, swing so that you feel that sole make flat contact again. Let the club be your school. Let the club be your guide to schooling you as to whether you're doing it right or not.
And that's your answer. That's a good one. That's a good question.
It is a good question because, and one of the things, and I think your listeners, and we talk about this, you know, every couple of weeks, is I'm all about the toolkit. And, you know, I'll talk about instruction. I understand the golf swing, everything. But the toolkit that we use to play the game is so crucial, so important. And having the right tools in our bag for our particular game and having those tools shafted properly and length and lie angles and the right loft to gap your set out. And we should talk more about the toolkit in future episodes, because I'm I mean, it is so important. You've got a big investment, and if you invested in the wrong things, you're going to be frustrated out there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I think that everyone is learning that you know what you're talking about. Well, at least you're opinionated, whether you know what you're talking about or not. You have an opinion about it, but it must be a good opinion because the Score Golf scoring clubs, your Score 41-61 clubs, put up against some of the major manufacturers, you're selling these at shows, and the response, even from the press, the response has been very, very good. Congratulations.
Well, thank you, Fred. We took a fresh approach at this end of the set, and I invite any of your listeners to look at their late model wedges or brand new wedges, whatever, and go compare them to some that are in the bargain barrels that date back to the 40s, 50s, 60s. This is the last club in the bag that has not caught up to the modern game that we play, the full swing power game. You know, and 50 years ago, nobody made full swings with wedges, and now everybody does. Mm-hmm. And the wedge did not catch up with that, and so people get ballooning trajectories and inconsistent distances, and it's not their fault. We give absolution here. It's not your fault. You're playing a 1950 model golf club with the 2013 model game, and there's a disconnect there, and there's better technology, and we've seen upstart companies challenge the status quo for the last 40 or 50 years in golf, and better technology wins every time, and you know, we hope all your listeners will give us a chance to show the better technology of Score Golf, and you can contact our sales guys and they can tell you the story, and if you're still a little skeptical, you can talk those guys out of a trial club.
Yeah, and you've got an amazing return policy, because if someone doesn't like the club, you'll go ahead. Well, I can say three or four things that you would do, but specifically.
First of all, I would wonder, how the heck did you not like this golf club? When you're
right.
But seriously, listeners, if you buy our golf club and you're buying it online, you're buying it without seeing it, and I understand there's a big risk there. So if you buy our golf clubs and you get them fitted out right and our guys help you out and you play them for a month, if your short range performance has not improved measurably, noticeably, call us, and we'll either tweak those golf clubs, change the shafts out, do whatever it takes, or we'll let you send them back, and we'll take the money you gave us, and we'll go out and buy you any other brand of wedge you think you'd like better.
That's an amazing offer, and I don't think any retailer would do that. So this is an amazing offer from the manufacturer. Phenomenal. And if you are interested in doing that, because you're a Golf Smarter listener, you get 10% on your purchase. All you have to do is, when you're talking on the phone or you're doing this online, just use the code GOLFSMARTER and you'll get 10% off. And if you buy all five of the clubs that they have to offer, you'll still get 10% off the entire order. Now, if you're a Golf Smarter member, you're going to get 15% off of your order, and it makes it worth joining Golf Smarter for members only, just to get that extra 5%, because it's going to pay for itself and make you very happy that you got such a great deal. The checkout code for the Golf Smarter members is on the homepage of the members only site at golfsmarter.com. And please submit your questions. We want Terry to answer it, and we want you to get a free wedge. Terry, thanks so much once again, and we'll speak with you soon.
I look forward to it. Thank you, Fred.
Well, clearly, I hope you listen in for part two of our members-only episode with John Graham. I've not had any aimpoint putting training yet, but just after John and I recorded this conversation, I met with John Grund, who's been on the show before and will definitely be back soon, because he wanted to show me how he's now teaching vector putting. We spent about an hour together, and then soon afterwards, I went out and played 18 holes at Stone Tree, which is a very tough course for me. And unbelievably, I sunk three putts over 20 feet, including about a 60-footer with a lot of left-to-right break. I had only 29 putts for the day, which is really good for me. So to my instructor's comments on the objective of golf, yes, a successful long putt is much more exciting and important than a long drive. So remember this, it's not about how long, it's about how close. Before we announce this week's Alpha Brain winners, I want to thank Onnit Labs for their support of Golf Smarter. Listen, Alpha Brain works for me. And as Matt Every has said, more and more players on the tour are discovering Alpha Brain and the benefit they received with increased focus from this effective brain food. that's not to say that it will work for everyone. Golf's hard. And frequently we have a lot of voices in our heads badgering us with every nuance of every swing. But that noise is loud and distracting, especially when it has nothing to do with golf. Actually, that's why I prefer to play at the end of the workday during the week, knowing that I have to get back in the studio to edit this or create that or follow up on a phone call or book a get. You've got the idea. Having the ability to stay focused and determined, the knack for staying calm in tense situations, is why Alpha Brain works for so many golfers and so many other extreme athletes. So give Alpha Brain a try and see if it works for you. And let me know your honest opinion. It helps me to know how you feel about it. I think that Onnit Labs appreciates your comments too. So click on their ad at golfsmarter.com and get 10% off your entire order because of their relationship with Golf Smarter. And they're so generous that if you order the 90 count bottle, you're going to get free gifts, golf gifts as well. So thank them. And thanks to our newest Golf Smarter members, Kim Swaim of Portland, Oregon, and Steve Dumble of Wantirra, Victoria, Australia. Congratulations, because both of you will receive a free 30 count bottle of Alpha Brain courtesy of Onnit Labs. One more thing. I'm in the process of rebuilding golfsmarter.com. Would like to make the website more robust, be a little more social. You know, you got to do this these days. So if you have any suggestions on what you'd like more or less of at golfsmarter.com, please let me know by clicking on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.